From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
As I sat with my team on March 13th, when the president declared the pandemic a national emergency for the U.S., we lamented the fact that this was going to hit primary care hardest as the first access to the healthcare system, and that we had no database and no infrastructure that would allow us to know what kind of impact was happening or how best to support primary care. So we determined that day that we needed to create it. So we launched a survey to see if it would work. We launched it on a Friday night, 7 p.m., and by Monday morning, we had over 500 responses. So we knew then that this was filling a deep need for the field, and we've continued it weekly since then. It continues to serve as one of the only resources for knowing what's happening in primary care practice on the ground right now.
Dr. Rebecca Epps, PhD, Associate Professor of Family Medicine and Population Health at Virginia Commonwealth University, and co-director of the Larry A. Green Center. A recent study at the time of this production by the Larry A. Green Center revealed that 86% of primary care patients believe racism is impacting their physical, psychological, and/or emotional health. The study, which reached a nationally representative sample of more than 1,100 primary care patients, along with a comparison study of 600 clinicians, revealed both patients and healthcare providers view racism as a public health issue. These findings come at a time when the national conversation is focused heavily on racial injustice in this country and shed new light on a new setting where conversation about racism impact can and should be held in doctors' offices. I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, how patients and healthcare providers view racism as a public health issue with Dr. Rebecca Epps, PhD, and Christine Bechtel in Black America.
I would add, I was also surprised by the fact that almost 9 in 10 Americans understand that racism is a health issue, period. We also asked if they think structural racism should be a concern of public health. And still, you know, more than a quarter said, yes, it should be a concern of public health. And so those numbers tell me as a patient advocate that the healthcare system has a moral imperative to respond. We are at an interesting moment of opportunity where COVID is really laying bare some of the biggest and previously known weaknesses in our healthcare system.
Christine Bechtel, patient advocate and co-founder of Third Conversation. To be a person of color in this country could be hazardous to your health. That's what a new study revealed conducted by the Larry A. Green Center. In fact, 1 in 5 primary care clinicians says the death of George Floyd has been a topic of conversation with patients when it comes to their health, and more than 40% of clinicians say it has been raised as a topic of concern across patients of all demographics. What's more, it's having an impact on healthcare providers' well-being. More than 30% of clinicians report feeling distressed about George Floyd's death. And while the COVID-19 pandemic has laid bare the healthcare inequalities in this country, the continual killing of African Americans by law enforcement has compounded the stress level. Recently, In Black America spoke with Christine Bechtel, a patient advocate and co-founder of Third Conversation, and Dr. Rebecca Epps, PhD, Associate Professor of Family Medicine and Population Health at Virginia Commonwealth University, and co-director of the Larry A. Green Center, regarding a study on racism and its impact on public health.
We're going to start with you, Dr. Rebecca. Can you give us a little background about yourself?
Sure. I am a cultural anthropologist trained at Rutgers University. I currently work in the Department of Family Medicine and Population Health at Virginia Commonwealth University School of Medicine.
And Christine, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm a consumer advocate by background. I have spent most of my career working on healthcare issues, primarily from the lens of consumer advocacy. So I've worked a lot with Congress and various administrations to make healthcare better for humans. in areas ranging from health information technology and access to medical records to reinventing the doctor-patient relationship. And I'm now a co-founder of X4Health, which is a purpose-driven organization on a mission to make healthcare better for all people.
Dr. Becker, two-part question. What are your responsibilities at Virginia Commonwealth University? And the second part of that question, tell us a little about the Larry A. Green Center.
Sure. So at VCU, I'm an associate professor of family medicine and population health. I largely do research. I lead a team of investigators, and we work on bridging the gap that currently exists between the business of medicine and the lived experience of the human condition. The Larry Green Center is focused on advancing primary health care for the public good. So there actually is no federal funder and no federal agency responsible for overseeing the questions that matter to primary care or how to best address them. So we established the Green Center in order to fulfill that mission.
Christine, tell us about the X4Health.
We are a purpose-driven organization founded by two consumer advocates and a nurse, and we specialize and are really passionate about social impact design. So we've created both targeted and large-scale programs that are designed to put people back at the center of our healthcare system and to just help the healthcare system work a lot better, particularly for patients and families, but also for the people who work within it. One of our most fun and favorite programs is something called Third Conversation, which is a grant-funded program that's bringing patients and families in the community together with their healthcare providers, their doctors, and their nurses to talk about what healthcare is really like in the system, whether you work in the system or you get care in the system, and think together about ways that we can improve it and make it more community-focused.
In reading about you, I found it interesting that you helped develop the shared principles of primary care. Tell us about that.
The shared principles of primary care are really a pretty miraculous document. So it's a document that describes the ideal state of primary care. And it's something that was originally started by three of the leading primary care physician organizations in the early 2000s. And we worked about 20 years later to modernize them from the perspectives of all of the diverse stakeholders that work in healthcare today. So obviously doctors, but also nurses and behavioral health providers, patients, families, community-based organizations, and others. So I was very privileged to co-chair the process with a fellow or with a physician and also with a healthcare payer. And we worked with a large community through the Patient-Centered Primary Care Collaborative and another organization called Family Medicine for America's Health. And we were able to bring over 300 organizations to a place of co-creating these principles that describe the ideal state of primary care and endorsing them as a roadmap to the future. So I'm very proud of that work and all of the people who were involved in it.
Dr. Becker, how did we get to the point where you all began conducting a survey around the pandemic?
Well, we're deeply invested in primary care. We believe that primary care serves the public good and population health, and very concerned about the lack of support for primary care in the U.S. in general. And I was involved in Family Medicine for America's Health and in the shared principles discussion that Christine facilitated. And I have a deep awareness of the lack of infrastructure and data support for the world of primary care. So as I sat with my team on March 13th, when the president declared the pandemic a national emergency for the U.S., we lamented the fact that this was going to hit primary care hardest as the first access to the healthcare system, and that we had no database and no infrastructure that would allow us to know what kind of impact was happening or how best to support primary care. So we determined that day that we needed to create it. So we launched a survey to see if it would work. We launched it on a Friday night at 7 p.m. And by Monday morning, we had over 500 responses. So we knew then that this was filling a deep need for the field, and we've continued it weekly since then. It continues to serve as one of the only resources for knowing what's happening in primary care practice on the ground right now.
And to build on that, this is Christine, when we saw the results of the work that Becca and her team was doing through the Green Center and with the Primary Care Collaborative, we were frankly blown away. So we immediately reached out and said, how can we help? What can we do to be part of this? And Becca's team was so responsive that not only did she invite us into the process as a partner on the clinician survey, but also created and stood up a separate patient survey so that we could elevate the voices of both patients and healthcare providers together. The impact that COVID is having on primary care is profound. It will be indelible, and it's quite scary. In our work around Third Conversation, where we're bringing patients and providers together in the community, we've really seen the centrality of the doctor-patient relationship, and we've seen the human impact that a poorly designed healthcare system was having on both patients and healthcare providers before the pandemic. So knowing that before the pandemic, 50% or more of primary care clinicians said they were burning out and getting ready to leave medicine, 10% were having suicidal thoughts. At the same time, knowing that the healthcare system overall wasn't really meeting patients' needs, we really saw an opportunity to jump in and try to support just elevating public and policymaker awareness around the terrible impact that the healthcare system is really facing right now.
This is probably a really good point for primary care in general. This tends to be about how a lot of primary care happens. This survey effort was started without funding. It was just simply a recognized need. Christine joined us without funding to help us elevate the voices we were gathering. We immediately put together a national advisory committee of primary care experts from around the country who participate in weekly conversation with us. They did that without funding. A lot of what happens without funding. We were able to get an initial investment about 4 weeks in from the Morris Singer Foundation, and then later a matching investment from the Samueli Foundation. Without that, we actually wouldn't be able to continue these surveys. And I think that's an indication of how anemic and under-resourced primary care as a platform is. And the fact that CMS or the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, the fact that the CDC, Center for Disease Control, and many other federal institutions are actually using our data right now because it's the best data available, but have not yet found a way to support the collection of that data, I think is an indication both of the mission of the field and of its lack of support generally.
How did you all go about constructing the survey as far as questions that you wanted to ascertain answers to?
Sure, that's a great question. We knew that primary care doctors were going to be really hard hit, so we didn't want to ask any questions that we couldn't act on immediately. That limited the number of questions we would ask. If we're gonna ask them for their time, man, it better have a purpose. So we were making sure of that. We also knew it had to be quick. These people are hard pressed. They're doing a tremendous amount of work. If it can't get done in 3 minutes, then it's just getting in their way. Mm-hmm. So we knew that it had to be short. And then we knew that a lot of the questions had to be structured versus open comments, because primary care in general, they don't get their data back. They have systems that they enter their data into, like their electronic medical records, but they can't actually get the data out of them, which is of no help at all. And we were driven to help primary care practices. So we asked only questions that we could act on in terms of informing policy that wouldn't take them much time to fill out, and that we could turn around and give them back their information within a 24-hour period. We usually do it within 8 hours. It's really important. There is an open text comment section in the survey, and we invite the people who fill out the survey to ask questions they think we need to ask. We partner with roughly 80 national organizations for primary care, and we ask them what questions best serve them. And we have our national advisory committee that each week helps us to go through the list and limit the questions so that they're responsive to what everybody needs, but also meet that requirement of being within 3 minutes and being meaningful and actionable.
We'll be back with more In Black America after this message. And now back to this episode of In Black America. With the racial animus going on, this is for both you, Dr. Rebecca, and Christine, how is this having an effect on the healthcare delivery systems?
So I'll start it off and then pass it to Christine. It's having a dramatic effect. And I can't speak to the whole healthcare system. I can speak specifically to primary care, but we actually asked about it in our survey. We asked not only just, we asked about racism, we asked about structural racism, and we asked in particular about the death of George Floyd and other similar events. And it's a story, John, of really remarkable sadness and remarkable hope, which I was honestly not expecting. You watch the news and you think that our society is extraordinarily divided. But what we saw in our surveys was, because we surveyed both patients and clinicians, we saw in our surveys that patients, 86% of patients were being affected, said that racism affected their health. 30% of our population surveyed was minority. So these are not just minority voices. This is 86% of the total saying that racism affects their health. And then when we said, well, what about your personal health? 50% of them said it affected their personal health. And then when we went deeper and said, has it affected your physical health? Has it affected your psychological health? We have 20% of people who, as a result of the death of George Floyd and other similar events, are reporting that it affected their physical and psychological health. When we talk to clinicians, this is just compounding for them. They have already been inundated by the pandemic. They're completely overwhelmed by the sense of need among their patients. They work an extraordinary amount of time and are having roughly fourfold the number of contacts with patients than they usually do. And when this hit, 60% of them said that the death of George Floyd and similar events was affecting their well-being. And 40% of them said their patients brought in concerns that related to what was going on in our society. This is huge. This is not small. This is a really big systemic problem. And we found that primary care in its relationship with its patients and the people that they serve, we're forging a shared sort of sense of distress and loss, and we were searching for ways to deal with that loss. Christine?
I think that's beautifully said, and it is both tragic and also hopeful in different ways. I would add, I was also surprised by the fact that almost 9 in 10 Americans understand that racism is a health issue, period. We also asked if they think structural racism should be a concern of public health. And still, you know, more than a quarter said, yes, it should be a concern of public health. And so those numbers tell me as a patient advocate that the healthcare system has a moral imperative to respond. We are at an interesting moment of opportunity where COVID is really laying bare some of the biggest and previously known weaknesses in our healthcare system. There will be a substantial national conversation about what we have to do to create deep change, not tinkering around the edges. And addressing racism in healthcare has to be a super top priority. So I found some hope in that. And I also felt really sad that, you know, half of people in this survey say that racism has affected their personal health. We can do better. And I want to point out one other thing that I think is really important for healthcare to address. It turns out that our healthcare system is primarily focused on medical care. But what makes for good medical care is completely different than what makes for good health. And what makes for good health is more so factors around poverty, around food insecurity, around housing security, and we know that Black communities are disproportionately profoundly more impacted in those areas because of structural racism. So it's past time, we've got to reorient the North Star of the healthcare system to address these systemic issues in a way that actually creates health rather than focuses just on the provision of medical care.
During this stay-at-home order, a lot of doctors' offices were closed. Hospitals reduced selective surgery, so that had an effect on the employees. Going forward, how would our new normal affect our health delivery systems?
Go ahead, Christine.
Nope, go ahead, Becca.
It's a great question, and the primary care never closed. Primary care is the largest of the healthcare platforms, and within 7 days, and we know because we survey them weekly, within 7 days, over 80% of the platform had converted to virtual care. So
okay.
They made themselves available by phone, by video, and by e-consultation, which is usually emailing back and forth. And they had an unbelievable amount of connection to their patients. They report not only having taken on digital health, but 70% of them had a whole new approach to outreaching to their patients to make sure that they were safe. The patients who were self-isolating or who had been to hospitals and were now returned home, both the patients and the clinicians, so we're getting it from both sides, report that their doctors just reached out to them to find out how they were doing and make sure that they were okay. I've interviewed doctors who have actually called their patients who have financial risks, financial uncertainty, and let them know, if you can't pay, please still come in. We are happy to see you. We're happy to take care of you. Let us know how we can help. So in that way, primary care has never closed its doors. The payment system in the U.S. does not support that kind of service and care. So the payment system has made it very difficult, and many practices have been operating since March or since April without any payment. And we've started to see a trend of practices closing because they don't have enough money to stay open. There were lots of systems and financial assistance that was provided to larger health systems and targeted some community health centers and hospitals, which is absolutely necessary and good. The problem is that there was no targeted intervention for primary care. And in the best of times, primary care handles 50% of all medical visits every year for the U.S. It's 500 million visits. We do it with a third of the workforce and 7% of the health expenditure. So we were already pretty hard-pressed, and we changed. We met what patients needed, and we have yet to see any support for primary care. It's going to get worse, and we need to figure out a way to make it clear that patients are turning to primary care for help. Primary care is there to meet them and is able to provide them with that help and help them with physical, mental, emotional, all sorts of issues related to racism, related to chronic illness, related to just undifferentiated upsetness and something's not right and I just need to talk to somebody to figure it out. We're there for that. But whether we will be able to continue to do that will depend on whether, frankly, our society continues to accept the unacceptable or whether it decides to step up and realize that the health of all the individuals is a principle by which we live.
Christine, what are you hearing on your end?
I'll say I think the delivery system is going through some profound changes if primary care survives. And that is a question mark. We're in the middle of a pandemic, and that is a question mark. So for the policymakers listening out there, it is beyond time to act. But here's what I'm seeing. I think we're going to see a big shift away from the reliance on in-person care, patients having to physically go all the time to the doctor's office. I think we'll see more virtual visits, more allowable phone calls, more video visits. I also think we're going to see more in-home care, where the healthcare system, for perhaps the first time in its life in certain ways, travels to the home of the patients, right? Because that really seeing us in our homes gives healthcare providers so much more clinical insight about what's actually driving our health. I also think that if primary care survives, it's going to have to develop more connections to community-based organizations who are really on the front lines of addressing what are called the known drivers or social determinants of health. Again, access to food, housing, jobs, job security. We are in the middle of a massive economic downturn. And so that ability to stay and develop connections with community-based organizations that can respond and help address those systemic issues is going to be critically important. I also would lastly say having a more integrated way to address mental and emotional health and well-being is going to be essential. One of the most interesting parts about the Green Center survey was that when we asked whether patients thought or people thought that primary care could help address racism, over a quarter said yes. That was really surprising to me, that people see primary care as a safe space to go and to process issues. And so we've really got to bolster primary care's connection to mental health and also to public health and to community-based organizations. So it's really an interconnected set of pillars that are totally focused on health creation instead of just medical care.
In the long term, how are these vents have an effect on the adolescent population?
You know, that's an awesome question, John. And I am not sure we know the answer from the Green Center data. I'll let Becca speak to that. But as a general matter, I think there are generational differences in expectations around healthcare and what the healthcare system does, and particularly the way we access it. Younger generations are totally accustomed or more accustomed to technology, and they tend to have different expectations of the healthcare system. They tend to bring the expectations they have for other, you know, consumer market industries into healthcare. But older people, middle-aged people, you know, people of my generation, we tend to have like lower expectations of the healthcare system because we're used to it not being all that great. So I am hopeful that younger generations will continue to put pressure on the healthcare system to be what it really can be and to think beyond the status quo and to question its institutions and its leadership. The youth in America have done an incredible job really changing the public dialogue, whether it's about racism or gun safety. And I think they can do the same thing in healthcare. But they're not to a point yet where they truly need healthcare. So that will be the big question in my mind, is what will be their catalytic event to engage in making the healthcare system be what it really should.
Christine Bechtel, patient advocate and co-founder of Third Conversation. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.